This week on the Special Ed Strategist.
Oh, I mean, they're not. This is a funny question because it doesn't, this is not something that you have to like, I wonder what's going on here. You feel it immediately. And then that experience of failing and then succeeding gets embedded. Like then now there's a new learning that has occurred. I think we need to take that same approach as helping professionals. They want to be accepted, as we all do. And so they might withhold and use a lot of mental energy to behave in the most effective way at school. And then they run out of that when they get home. We're in and out of there in 12 weeks or whatever it takes, right? With a young person, they're not aware of the cost. And if they are, it doesn't affect them directly. And, they're not coming in with the same goals typically that the parents have. So we have to really take our time with young person, build that relationship, and then leverage that relationship to be able to bring about the change that's necessary. So all of these questions are great, but I just want to make sure we're speaking to the underlying issue, which is we've got to connect with these kids. And there's great research that shows just one person who connects with the kid can be the lifesaver. Like the what we think affects how we feel. But the problem is that of the 60,000 or so thoughts that we have in a day, the majority of them are complete nonsense. They're not true, they're judgments, they're false. You wouldn't share them with other people, some of them, right? And this is true for everybody. So we can't trust our thoughts. We can't treat our thoughts as facts. We have to be willing to say, is there another perspective I could take on this?
Hello and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Our guest today is a leading adolescent therapist with over 30 years of experience specializing in treating resistant teens using evidence-based approaches. He is also an acclaimed author and speaker. So Brett's experience making him the perfect guest today as we explore managing students' resistance, including factors like PDA, anxiety, and executive function. Brett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Wendy.
Yeah, you bet. Can you just take a couple of seconds and give us a little bit more background about who you are and what you do in the world of supporting students with a variety of learning, behavioral, emotional needs?
Yeah, I'm a clinical social worker. I work only with adolescents and young adults. So, like, technically, adolescents, haven't launched yet. And I've always been interested in and wanted to learn more about how to treat those who are not getting the treatment that they deserve. And so a lot of times these young people who are more challenging, push back, can be hostile even towards helping professionals, teachers, et cetera. Understandably, it's hard to stay engaged and stay motivated with kids who are so challenging. And so it was my experience that they often got left behind and sort of given up on, so to speak. And so that has been my interest. And I have really devoted my entire career. I see all the range of young people, but my favorites are the ones who are really have had two or three maybe unsuccessful therapy experiences, or maybe have been struggling and bounced around in school programs, the ones that aren't being effectively managed.
Absolutely. And I join you with that favorite part, although I always say I don't pick favorites. But my first gig in the world of special education was high school juvenile delinquents, and I really loved it. I loved just working with that population and that students and getting them engaged and gaining their trust and all the terrific things that we're going to talk about today. Before we set that stage of kind of those comments, what that looks like as a resistant student, I always ask my guests, what is one thing that necessarily does not align with what you're doing now? It could be a hobby, an interest that people may not know about you.
Well, so you'll hear as we talk more that anxiety underlies a lot of these issues that we see with the kids that are more challenging. It's sort of what I call invisible anxiety, like it's masked. So the treatment for anxiety is exposure. And that means we have to do the things that are difficult. I know you're like, where is he going with this? This is not answering my question, but I'm moving
I
there.
was thinking, huh, all right, we're
I'm
just going to
moving
skip
there.
that one.
So one of the things as a exposure therapist is that we would never ask a client to do something we wouldn't do. And so I have made a habit of engaging in activities that are frightening for me. And so every year I pick something. I'm still working on next year's, but this year I did a stand-up comedy routine at a comedy club. The year before I jumped out of an airplane, and the year before that I swam across the Chesapeake Bay. So I find things to do that challenge me personally and are aligned with my own values and goals. And then I push myself to do the things that are hard. So stay tuned. I'm not sure what 2025 will bring, but I'm thinking.
I definitely need an update. And I love that you do that. I have always been the mindset of somebody asks me out of my comfort zone, I'm going to do it, but maybe I need to take it to the next step and just start to put myself out there. And doing stand-up comedy is no joke. My son did it and he had a 5-minute stint at the improv and I was so nervous for him, but on the outside, I'm sure same with you, you just did it with grace and nobody thought you were nervous at all.
Right. I don't think they did, but I was. And that's the trick to dealing with anxiety is do it scared, right? Like, don't wait until you're not scared. Do it scared. And that's how the fear goes down.
That is a terrific nugget. So let's set this stage. What are some common signs of student resistance?
They're not. This is a funny question because it doesn't, you know, this is not something that you have to like, I wonder what's going on here. You feel it immediately. It might be a student being disrespectful to you, not complying with requests, being disruptive in the classroom, or stirring up trouble with other kids. There are any number of things, being sent out of the room, being sent out of the room on a flash pass and then not returning for the rest of the day, going to the counselor's office and refusing to leave the counselor's office, you know, all the things that educators struggle with kids in school, not coming to school, very common, or coming late or leaving early, that kind of thing.
How, as a parent or an educator or professional in general, how can we start to tell that difference between kind of resistant behavior, but something that could be then more complex, like PDA, pathological demand avoidance, that we're going to get into here in a second?
Right, right. Well, I would ask folks to consider that if you ever have a behavior that you're framing. So you said you worked with folks in the incarcerated youth at one point, and I did too. And if we frame the behavior as criminal or oppositional or resistant, you know, then we're going to respond to it with authority typically. And authority just results in more pushback with these kids typically. So the goal would be to frame it as something else. And it is always something else. So you have, we think about like kids are doing the best they can with the skill set that they have. And all kids want to do well. All humans want to do well. So whenever we stumble, whenever we do something that's problematic, it's a signal that there's either a skills breakdown or there's an emotional interference that's getting in the way. Because when emotion goes up, cognition goes down. And so, and you see this frequently with young people and administrators or teachers, they're told, listen to me, problem solve, but their emotions are way up and they can't do it in that moment. And if you ask somebody to do something they're not capable of doing, you have a choice. If you're a young person, you have a choice. You either sort of submit to being stupid, so to speak, right? Or you push back, right? Like, I refuse. And so what we want to do is we want to change that way of looking at it to, this young person is struggling with how to respond in this situation for reasons that may be unknown to me as the teacher or the therapist or the parent even. And my job, because I'm the grown-up, my job is to help figure that out. Like, what is getting in the way here? Coming at it from a respectful, thoughtful perspective and collaboratively, ideally, if you build the relationship, figure out what's getting in the way and then solve the problem and teach them how to do that in another more effective way. So instead of saying F you to the teacher, maybe they say, can I speak with you after class? Right? Like, or if they're being spoken to after class, say, I'm really struggling with what you're trying to explain to me. Can you repeat it? You know, we want to give them languages and skills that they can use and scripts they can use with authority figures so that they don't make things worse for themselves. So the short answer is let's reframe resistance as struggling with a skills deficit or emotional interference, and then teach them either the skill to manage the emotion or the skill they need in that particular situation.
And understanding that breakdown and having that knowledge is really empowering. What are your recommendations for that collaboration for educators, for parents, and folks like yourself, mental health professionals? I feel like there's oftentimes silos in how things are supported within supporting our students. So what is a good recommendation to encourage that pause to say, all right, what is really truly going on here? And what can we do as a collaborative team to support the student that's struggling?
Right. Well, I think about the metaphor of like a student taking a math test and they get something wrong. They get a question wrong. Right. And the student who is going to achieve is going to go back and look at that question, figure out what they did wrong, in a sense, teach themselves or have the teacher or somebody teach them how to do it properly. And then that experience of failing and then succeeding gets embedded. Like then now there's a new learning that has occurred. I think we need to take that same approach as helping professionals. So when we interact with a young person and they lose it, you know, they throw the thing at you or they storm out of the room or they say something inappropriate, that's not the time to do any problem solving, right? Let's let the dust settle. Maybe it takes 10 minutes. Maybe it takes a day. Maybe it takes till the weekend if you're a parent or next week if you're a teacher. But wait till the time when they're no longer dysregulated, when their emotions and their cognition are back in line. And then sit down and in a very, this takes a willingness to let go of this sort of hierarchy, right? Sit down and say, hey, you know, last week when I said X, Y, or Z, or when this request was made, you did this thing. I'm really curious about what was going on there, right? Like an open, curious mindset, inviting the young person to share with you. Now, of course, the problem is many of these young people have had hundreds of experiences with authority figures where they've been mistreated, frankly. And so their nervous system is set up to respond as though you're about to mistreat them. So these are not one and done conversations. You have to build this relationship over time. But you could do it in 3 months if you're a teacher. You know, like if you're the new teacher, 11th grader, they've had 10, 11 years of problematic interactions with authority figures. You could turn that around in 3 or 4 months if you bring this consistent, gentle, curious, thoughtful, collaborative approach. So the way I like to do it is I'm wondering, you know, I try to like be curious, you know, like what was that? I'm trying to figure out. I know there had to have been something that got you so upset or there was something that you were struggling with and I just can't figure it out, and invite them to help me figure it out. And then together we identify whatever the problem might be. You know, speaking of PDA, I'll get to that in just a second, but with an autistic kid, for example, maybe the problem is that it was the last 10 minutes of the classroom was unstructured time and the noise level got to be too much for them and they were overwhelmed by that. And maybe we could do something simple, like give them the loop earplugs, you know, or foam earplugs to put it. Or they could take a break during that 10-minute period or go to the resource teacher during that time. You know, there's lots of things we could do if we can figure out what it is. But our problem is that we often make assumptions about what it is. And then we're way off base in terms of the interventions that we give.
So good. So good. And it's that consistency and showing up and kind of trying to take that neutral position as an adult. And we all get it, you know, as educators, as parents, professionals, there are times that it's just reminding yourself and having that consistency is empowering to support the lagging skills that our students are experiencing and keeping that framed in our head and also being able to explain to the other professionals that are in your realm, right? So if you're an educator and you're giving that student some space to calm down, to be able to articulate to that professional of the why in what you're doing so that they can then start to come on board and understand the process so that everybody is understanding what's happening.
And that's tricky too, because so from the therapist side, I might call up the teacher and say, tell me what's going on. And the first thing I get typically is an unloading of frustration about the young person, right? Which is totally understandable. So what I'm going to do there is I'm going to validate for them that this is really challenging, right? I'm going to do the same thing for the teacher that I'm doing for the young person, right? Like this is understandable. This makes sense. This is hard. And then I'm going to be the child's advocate and ally, right? But in a very gentle way, because I have to have that relationship with the teacher, just like I have to have the relationship with the parent and the young person and the administrator, right? Like I'm playing the whole gang. So I have to, and this is what a good effective IEP meeting is on some level, right? Like, but then I want to bring them on board, right? Like, you know, I think that this may be what's going on. Do you think that could be true? And let me get some data from the teachers or the administrators about what they're noticing in the classroom. So I want to collaborate with them as well. So in a sense, you know, a lot of times FBAs get put together, and in my experience, they can be relatively simplistic. They can be well done, but they can often not be well done. And so in a sense, that's what we're trying to do, is an analysis of what is causing this behavior. Because if we know that the algebra equation is A plus B plus C equals outburst, then we can change A, B, or C, right? Or we can modify A, B, or C, but we have to figure out what A, B, and C are. And A might be didn't get a good night's sleep. B might be bullied in the lunchroom. And then C might be teacher makes a demand when the child hadn't studied for the test, right? So it's an adding up of vulnerabilities. And then we can approach each of those things and figure out ways to address them.
Can we then go back and just talk a second about pathological demand avoidance? And then I also want to bring in like anxiety and executive function, how all of this can play into a role either collectively or separately for right. Our students with lagging skills that look like resistance.
Love it. I wish you were all my clients' educational advocates. You just have the mindset. So PDA, you know, keep in mind, this is not in the DSM. This is a clinical description of what we're seeing in some autistic kids and adults, by the way. And what it is, we know there's actually brain scanning that shows when you put an autistic individual in a brain scanner and then you have them make eye contact, you'll see the amygdala light up. You know, the fight or flight response gets activated with eye contact, which is why eye contact is avoided, right? Among a lot of people with autism. The same thing happens when a demand is made, that it's perceived by some people as a threat. So if your friend says, hey, can you pick me up at 9 today? You might, if you're not autistic, you might be like, okay, right, I'll be there, right? But if somebody who's autistic hears a demand like that comes sort of suddenly and without warning, they might push back with that. So the pushback is the same as I was describing in the classroom. It might be a firm no, it might be resistance, it might be calling you names, it might be slamming the door, whatever it might be. But again, it's a signal among autistics with PDA. So think of it in terms of the desire for control. And the lack of control kicks up the nervous system, makes people anxious, makes all of us anxious to some degree, but more so with autistic folks. And so when they experience that lack of control, then they get angry and upset. So we prefer to call it in the field, we prefer to call it pervasive drive for autonomy, because it really describes what's occurring better. And again, if you flip the script, right, and we instead of saying pathological demand avoidance, we say this child is really striving to be independent and autonomous, and this is a threat to that. That gives us information we can use. So instead of saying, bring your backpack downstairs now so we can leave, we might say, it's 10 of 9, we're leaving in 10 minutes, right? Like you're not telling them what to do, you're giving them sort of the landscape and then allowing them to kind of figure out now the connection between PDA and executive skills. So you think about the way the brain functions, we've got two kind of main, I mean, this is complicated and I'm breaking it down in a simplistic way, but we have the emotional system and we have the cognitive system. So when we're in our cognitive system, we're launching rockets, we're building bridges, we're solving calculus equations, et cetera. When we're in our emotional system, we're really feeling emotion. We might be at a funeral or a wedding or witnessing a child being born or something. It's just pure emotion in those moments. The thing to think about is that these two things work together. That's regulation. Right? Like our cognition and our emotion balance each other out. They're like a teeter-totter. So when cognition goes way up, emotion goes way down. So when you're launching a rocket to the moon, you're not emotional. And you hear that in the voices of the folks, you know, in the space industry. You know, we have a problem with the cockpit, you know, very bland, you know, very concrete, cognitive. When we're emotional, our cognition goes down. And so we don't think as clearly. This is why we, when people get really angry, we say they lose IQ points temporarily. They just become, you know, emotionally driven. And then they do things that are driven by like wanting to get away from something or protect themselves based on misinformation that causes other problems. So what we get is when, so executive skills are part of the cognitive sphere, right? So if emotion goes way up, our executive skills, which may already be compromised, because you may have ADHD and executive functioning problems to begin with. Of course, every adolescent to some degree does, but you know, like some more than others. So when our emotions go way up, our cognition is going to go way down. And so is our problem solving ability, our ability to strategize, our ability to keep our eye on the long-term goal and think about what do I do right now that helps me get to the long-term goal, like a chess player would do, right? Like I see if I take this bishop right now, it's going to feel really good, but I'm not thinking ahead. So then they're going to checkmate me, right? So we have to be teaching our kids to do the same thing. And the way we do that is teach them how to regulate the nervous system to bring that emotion down and the cognition back up. Then they're in a position to be able to respond effectively to a problem.
What are some tricks and strategies that you have seen to kind of help realign that, bringing the emotion back down and then putting the cognitive back?
The first thing is awareness. You have to know that you're getting dysregulated, right? So we do a lot of teaching using emotion language, different words we can use, you know, I'm irritated versus I'm enraged, you know, like how can you communicate to other people how you're feeling in a particular moment so that they can intervene and help you, or you can ask for help. If you hide that, if you keep in, which often kids are told, you know, just keep it to yourself or whatever. And then they don't share it. And then it gets to be 90 on the scale of 100. And then, you know, all bets are off. It's going to be a problem. So the first thing is awareness. That could be awareness for the young person. How do you start to notice that you're getting dysregulated? Oh, I notice when my heart rate goes up, or I notice when I feel heat in my face, or I notice when my breathing changes, or I notice when I feel my muscles tense up, or whatever it might be for that particular young person, but helping them notice that. And also helping the adults notice, because a lot of times we have to cue the kids, right? Like, hey, I notice you seem kind of tense. Would this be a good time to take a little break? You know, like cueing and teaching. So that's number one, awareness. Number two is acceptance, allowing the emotion to be there, because every emotion makes sense. So we're going to allow it, be curious about it. I wonder why this emotion is showing up, right? And now what is this doing? It's building in pause. So if I'm paying attention to my emotion and not acting on it, just, isn't this interesting? Anger has shown up or anxiety has shown up. I wonder what's going on here, right? Now, by even doing that, I'm pulling up the cognitive system, right? And if I pull up the cognitive system, I'm going to push down the emotional system. So we would do something like that. And then finally would be some sort of action move. Like, what do I do in this particular situation to be effective? Maybe I just refocus my attention on what I'm doing this weekend, so I'm not feeding that anger. Or maybe I take a mental break from what's going on in the classroom right now. Or maybe I take a physical break. Or maybe I focus in on the teacher and describe his or her face to myself silently as a mindfulness exercise to reground me and get me reconnected to the present moment. Not what I think is happening, but what is happening. Because the problem with these young people, they are responding the way folks with PTSD respond. They get activated. All the memories of previous mistreatment get emerge, and then they respond to you as though you are all of those other people, right? And so it's just like the vet who responds to the car backfiring response as though it's a bomb going off, right? So we have a treatment for this. It's exposure-based, of course, and it's an anxiety disorder, PTSD. But we first have to teach people, like, this is what's happening. Frame it this way. Your brain's trying to protect you. There's really nothing wrong with you. Your brain's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's just problematic in this setting because of your learning history and your biology. So like with PDA, we would think about biology. Like those children are born with a nervous system that's more reactive than maybe the average person's nervous system. So we want to be sensitive to that. And we don't go around purposely upsetting people. Right? Like if you told me, Wendy, I don't like surprise parties, right? And I'm your friend and I throw you a surprise party, that would be really disrespectful to you, right? So why are we any different when an autistic individual says, I don't like crowds? And then we put them in the assembly. You know, like, why can't we be more sensitive to what their needs are and figure out how do we, maybe we have them do the assembly by video in the counselor's office or something. You know, there's ways we can work around typically all of the things that are sort of biologically based. So winding answer, I don't know if that gets to where you were asking.
No, there's a lot of nuggets, and I know people are furiously taking notes and hopefully going to replay this and share it, because there's just a lot of information that really can support all of the adults that are supporting an individual student. So I do want to talk about some sensory sensitivities. You did bring that up, but I also want to take a step back because you had mentioned the word masking, and I want to see how kind of, if you could explain what that is and how does this kind of come into play with the lagging skills or the skill breakdown of looking like something is resistant if we're masking?
Well, so we think about masking in terms of kids who are hiding their actual reactions, and they're sort of using a lot of energy to maintain a sort of appropriate, what we might call appropriate, you know, school demeanor. There's research that shows that self-control is a typically like a finite battery that you wake up with every day. And if we use a lot of self-control during the day, and kids usually do this, right? Like, because they don't want to be mistreated by their peers. That's primarily why they do it. Not so much the teachers, but, you know, they want to be accepted, as we all do. And so they might withhold and use a lot of mental energy to behave in the most effective way at school. And then they run out of that when they get home. So that's why we see the kids who, you know, where the teachers say, we never see any problems. And the parents are saying they're punching a hole in the wall, right? Those are those kids, because they run out of that self-control by the time they get home. Autistic folks will often mask, meaning that they will behave in ways that are understood to be more socially appropriate, and in a sense, hide who they really are. And then that also takes a toll on them. That's energy that they're expending to do that thing. You know, it would be like, I often talk to young athletes, and I'm like, you know, when you play a sport, like if you're playing basketball, when you play effectively, you're in the flow, right? You're not thinking about playing basketball. You're just playing basketball. But masking is kind of like playing basketball and thinking about playing basketball, right? Like, it's double gravity. Like, it's the normal challenge plus the additional challenge of having to think about how does this look and how am I going to manage this? So what it does is it impacts flow. So when we're masking, we typically aren't going to be as spontaneous and go with the flow with our friends and teachers, but we might be appearing more neurotypical by doing that. So it's a trade-off, of course. And in the autistic community, you know, there's a move towards unmasking, like just being who you are. Let's just accept people the way they are. And there's value in autism, just like there's value in just about everything. Everything has two sides to it. So we don't want to throw it completely out, you know, and there's also value to masking. You know, in certain situations, you want to mask, right? Like if you're in a college interview, you don't want to go on and on about your special interest. You know, you want to keep that to 2 minutes when they ask you what you find interesting.
Then how do we kind of take in with adding sensory sensitivities to this conversation?
Well, again, so we're going to have to assess it with the young person. Like, what is it? What are you finding overwhelming? Is it the taste? Is it the smell? Is it the noise? Is it the clothing textures? Is it, and beyond that, even, is it the lack of consistency or there's just so many. The short answer to everything you're asking me is we have to assess uniquely with that child, because every child is different. You've never met the same young person twice. And we have to approach every young person in that way. But let me just back up a second, because you're asking me really great questions about what do we do? And here's the problem. I can give you all the things to do, but unless we have that relationship with the young person, none of these things are going to work. So this is what I struggle with on the mental health side, I am an evidence-based therapist. So I go out and learn treatments that work, meaning they've been studied in labs. We know they work. The problem with those treatments is that they only take willing participants into the treatments, right? When they're doing the research. So the research is based on willing participants. So we have to get a willing participant if we're going to deliver an evidence-based treatment. So how do we do that? It's true for everybody, but especially with young people, we really have to focus on building that relationship. And we have a number of things. A colleague of mine, Julie Barron, and I wrote a book on what works with teens, which is really the idea is how do we build this underlying fundamental, essential core relationship that then allows you to put all of this stuff on top, right? Like all the podcasts you do are about what do you put on top of that, right? But how do you build the relationship? So we talk about you've got to demonstrate respect for the young person. You've got to show them that you understand and that you respect them as a person, even if their behavior is really problematic, right? Like them, you can respect the behavior. We don't have to, but we can even respect that the behavior has a function. You know, like if the kid is rude to the teacher and the teacher sends them out of the room and what they wanted to do was get out of the room, mission accomplished, right? Like the behavior has a function. So we want to have respect. We want to be authentic. That means we have to be real and we can use our own personalities. That's what I think makes it work is when you interact as an adult with a young person, being real, true to yourself, modeling for them. You can be you. Don't be anybody else. Be you, right? Like, and you can model that with your own quirks and whatever it is that you bring. Then we have to be kind. That, I mean, it goes without saying, right? But sadly, it doesn't. We have to be kind. Wendy, some of my worst memories are sitting in IEP reviews and having unkind things said to the child right in front of the child. And it just breaks my heart, right? And what are we modeling? And then we upset with them when they're unkind, right? So just problematic. Then we need to be predictable. Meaning, if we say we're going to do something, we follow through, right? Like so in a sense, we're asking the young people to do all the things we're going to model for them. And then finally, we have to accept the young people as they are. Like even with all of their problematic behaviors and you know, stinkiness and all the things they bring, right? Like young people, we still want to accept them, in a sense, love them, right? Like we would our own family members when they are being challenging. And then lastly, we can't get here to this last point unless we've done all these other ones. But lastly, after all of that, we can focus on change. And change is the intervention, right? But this is why when parents bring a child to therapy, a lot of times they can get frustrated we know therapy with children takes longer than it takes with adults. You know, if you or I went in to see a therapist, we're very conscious of the cost and the time, and we have a specific goal and, you know, we're in and out of there in 12 weeks or whatever it takes, right? With a young person, they're not aware of the cost. And if they are, it doesn't affect them directly. And, you know, they're not coming in with the same goals typically that the parents have. So we have to really take our time with young person, build that relationship, and then leverage that relationship to be able to bring about the change that's necessary. So all of these questions are great, but I just want to make sure we're speaking to the underlying issue, which is we've got to connect with these kids. And there's great research that shows just one person who connects with the kid can be the lifesaver. So it could be the coach, it could be the teacher, it could be the tutor, it could be the resource teacher, it could be the therapist, it could be the neighbor, it could be the grandmother, it could be mom or dad. It's just one person, youth group leader, scout leader, whatever. You know, we have a whole arena of people to choose from. So if we can just get one of them to kind of bring this sort of collaborative, relationship-based problem solving to the young person, then we can find our way out of the woods.
Which is tremendous to set that up like that in terms of we're not going to move forward unless that kid feels safe with somebody.
Exactly.
And it has to be either, ideally, it would be home, school, and community.
Yes.
But finding an adult that they feel, okay, this person is going to take the time, be consistent, be fair, you know, let's set that field up and then help bring in other people for their team, I think is incredible because we had mentioned FBAs and I was going to bring that up, but I'm really thankful that you did set the stage because we could have a brilliantly written IEP or FBA, but if there's not a connection to be had, that student is not available cognitively to move forward and grow within that capacity of a school setting.
Right. And then we think, even beyond that, like what's the young person's goal? Like what do they want to achieve? And then we have to connect everything to that, right? So like if my young client wants to be in the NBA, 13-year-old client, right? Between you and me, I know that that's a long shot, right? But I'm not going to say, No. You know, like, why would I do that? Right? Like, that's somewhat developmentally appropriate. So what are we going to do? We're going to take that desire to be in the NBA, and we're going to talk about practice and commitment and dedication and excellence. And we're going to find ways to get those goals in the school setting or the home setting, because you're going to need these goals for the NBA, right? Like, and then we get to the, now, of course, when they're 16, they don't want to be in the NBA anymore now, right? Like, that's just typical childhood. But we can take wherever they are now and whatever their interest is in now. Like, I was talking to a teacher, and the child's interest was like the metro system, you know, like the maps of the metro system and the different train cars and which series they were and things like that. And she allowed him to modify an assignment so he could write it with the metro system integrated into the assignment, right? So that what she's doing is taking his interest, which increases his motivation to do the assignment. And then she gets her goal met, which is it's a writing assignment and she can work on writing skills. Right. So I think it requires this flexibility, and rather than he won't do what I'm asking him to do, which provokes a pushback, you know, like opposition, we think of it like, he doesn't want to do what I want to do. I wonder what he might like to do, and then how we can both get our needs met here, not unilaterally.
So what are some accommodations that you have seen in the work that you are doing and also being at the IEP table and supporting kiddos in school that have, we've mentioned some, but that can really help maybe integrate into the next IEP or conversation that we're having with the school to better support our students?
Gosh, there's so many. In light of PDA, I was just thinking about kids. You know, we all know these kids who are like super bright that, you know, get A's on every test, but they don't do any homework, right? Like, they demonstrate that they know the material, but they don't do hand in their homework, maybe because of executive skills. Or with autism, a lot of times, like, why should I do this? I get this. This is busy work. Why do I have to? There's like I'm drawing a line in the sand. I'm not going to do it, right? So then why are we penalizing them? Like, my view is, if you can show mastery of the material, then if you can prove that to me, then I don't need the homework, right? Like you're clearly getting it. Now, we know that those kids often hit the wall somewhere. And I mean, these things are complicated. And a lot of times the really bright ones, they can compensate with intelligence until they get to 10th grade or 11th grade or even college sometimes. So we want to still teach the study skills, but I think our big thing is we want to stay out of power struggles with these young people. So in terms of IEP accommodations, I always want the young person at the meeting. I always want to prep them for the meeting. And I want to collaboratively say to them, what do you think would be useful for you? Do you want to sit in the back of the room? I had a young person once with ADHD, and he could be really disruptive when he got bored in class. And we came up, I don't even know if this was on the IEP, Wendy, but we came up with a deal with the teacher where he could sit in the back of the room. And when he was done with his work, he could read a book. He could just pull out like a novel, like a spy novel, and just read. And that was fine. That made the classroom function work more effectively. Didn't make him angry. You know, it's like they found a way to, you know, he got what he needed from the class. Teacher got what he or she needed from the class. And then off we went, you know, to the next period. So I think flexibility is the key. And I know we go to IEP meetings, they have the computer program, you know, that pulls down different goals. I find, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of money and thought went into those goals, but I like to really personalize those goals to this particular child.
I'm sorry, I'm over here cringing. The whole time I'm shaking my head and people can't see me shaking my head, and we're very in alignment with everything together here. And then I had to cringe.
And because even when they read that goal, which was written by, you know, PhD educators which I respect, right? But it doesn't resonate with the young person. So we've got to reword the goal, because like they should have their IEP. I encourage them to have their IEP in their notebook. You know, like, be aware of what you are entitled to this, at least right now. So you are entitled to this. And so fight for your entitlements.
I was talking on a podcast, and I've done some solos about this in terms of prepping the child, the student, for the IEP. Because if you think about, as a parent coming in with a parent heart of fear and love, right? You only want the best for your baby. You want them to be safe. You want them to grow. And you walk into that IEP meeting and it's like a business meeting. And I always liken it to you're walking into a social party, the music's going, people are talking, having a good time. And as soon as you walk in the door, and everybody looks at you. So you
Right.
feel very uncomfortable. And so for a student that does not have that adult mindset, it can be very overwhelming. So really setting the stage for that student based on their age and what's appropriate for them of these are the people that are going to be there. This is the conversation that's going to be had. And then also having them let you know, like how long you want to be a part of that meeting, because some students don't want to sit the hour to go through the legality and all of that. They want to be able to come and share, this is my strengths, these are my needs, this is what's working, this is what's not working, and then they want to leave. Very rarely have I had a student say, yeah, I want to sit through the entire process because it's exciting to me. But just having, prepping them and having some conversations with an adult that they feel comfortable and safe with, that they can say, okay, this is really what I need. And then really going beyond that is I always prep parents when they do their parent input statement to say, all right, where do you see yourself, your child in 6 months? Where do you see yourself, your child in, you know, and having that conversation with the student and the parent in a year, 3 years and 5 years. So we can start setting up that support system, the IEP, external resources to continue to build the capacity of that student in a successful manner.
Oh my gosh, I could talk for an hour based on all what you just said. So yes, 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 yes. And I just want to say that I have been to many, many, many wonderfully effective IEP meetings. I want to get the ratio right. You know, it's the ones Absolutely. That are problematic that stand out in our memories, right? But there are so many wonderful teachers and administrators and special educators and resource teachers. I'm so grateful to all of them and all that they do for the kids that we work with. Yes, I, as a therapist, I do the same thing because I want them to know I'm going to be coming in to this meeting in a different role. So here, you know, I'm connecting with you, but I'm in this meeting, I'm going to be like fighting for you. And so you may see a different side of me, you know, and sort of role playing that a little bit. And the other thing I like to do with kids in meetings is get their permission ahead of time. Can I prompt you on some things if I notice that you're not including certain information? You know, we might decide what they want to say. But like you say, when you walk into that meeting, can you imagine if you walked into a meeting and they had your psychological testing? Your boss was there, you know, like your coworkers were there, and they all were going to do like a 360 review on you. Like it would be really overwhelming. So this idea of like empathizing, which you just articulated so well, like what it's like to be the young person in this situation gives us just intuitively, you know, people who work with kids love kids. We don't get into this work in the beginning for money. Like this is not, you know, these aren't high paying careers for the most part. Sometimes people can find niches in it that do better than others, but it's, you know, I come from a family of teachers, you know, and they didn't get into it for the money, you know, they loved teaching. So the people who are there love kids, you know, but and if we can just get them to sort of keep that love for the kids, even when the kids are prickly, you know, and just see it as this kid's prickly and then try to pull in like what you just did, that empathy for what must this feel like for him or her in this moment, and see beyond all that nonsense behavior that we're seeing that it distracts us, you know, and focus in on what's really going on here. They're getting anxious. They're afraid. They're overwhelmed. They feel attacked. They've been traumatized in the past. They don't feel safe, you know, whatever it might be. And then we can come in and we can start to soothe that nervous system. I've had IEP meetings where I've seen it getting hot and I know that the kid is getting a little dysregulated. And I've even said, can we take a timeout for a moment and then go talk to the kid separately and say, do you want to stay or do you want to go? You know, because I don't want, I've seen meetings where I've had the thought, like, are they trying to get this kid upset? You know, like, you know, sometimes we have to tiptoe in, you know, and I know they're busy. I totally get both sides, but I'm the advocate for the kid. And so I'm going to fight for the kid.
To step in a different direction, we've put some terminology out there. I'd like to just add one more terminology, oppositional behavior. How does that all wrap into this?
Well, that's my love, honestly. When I started out, that's what I focused on, was treating kids who were diagnosed with ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, and conduct disorder. You know, those two conditions, I have to say, I've been doing this for 30 some years. I don't know that I've ever met a kid who, maybe one, who had ODD. You know, I've met hundreds who were told they had ODD or conduct disorder. But when we really, I don't think oppositional defiant disorder is going to stick around. You know, it'll be like one of those diagnoses that gets thrown off eventually, I think, as we understand better what's really driving the behavior. So ODD, and all the research on ODD is it's typically a complex interplay of learning disabilities, nervous system vulnerabilities, neurodivergences, ADHD, impulse control problems, et cetera. It's not, so if we say ODD, what is that? That tells us they're oppositional. We need to force them to comply, right? And then what do we get from that? Trauma, because those kids get kidnapped from their homes and sent to wilderness programs. With the best of intentions from therapists and parents and consultants and whatnot, and then put in residential facilities. And what do they learn? They learn how to live in a residential facility. So my focus is really, how do we teach these kids to live in this community? I recognize it's not all or nothing. There are times where safety is the highest priority. And the safety is so much of a concern that we have to utilize programs like this. But there's a cost to those programs, both financially and psychologically to kids. So we have to be very mindful about that. And so to that point, I would say, and even with ODD, what we call ODD, a lot of that work is teaching parents how to be super parents, how to really effectively manage challenging behaviors. We have the tools for this. It's not intuitive. And it's counterintuitive, and it's not what you're going to read in a typical parenting book for ODD. But we do have tools for this. And if we can get parents to start utilizing those tools, teach them, we have to teach them the tools, right? Same ideas we're talking about with the kids. If they're not using the skills, that we have to assume either their emotions getting in the way or they don't know the skill, right? And it's usually both. And so if we can teach them how to regulate their emotions as parents, and then teach them the specialized skills for kids that are more challenging like this, then they can model both of those things for their kids. And we typically see progress. It's a long term. It's like those kids that come in at 12 or 10 with that kind of behavior, breaking things, throwing things at their parents, having the police called to the house, that treatment might take a year or two to get them stabilized. It's not a short term intervention, but it's a lot cheaper in the long run than wilderness residential treatment. You know, and there's less trauma to the child. So yeah, I could do a whole day on oppositional defiant disorder and my feelings about it. But I think what I would do is break it down into what are the contributors: learning disabilities, executive functioning issues, impulse control problems, emotion dysregulation. I liken it to like, if you had a broken ankle, had something wrong with your ankle, and your job was running in marathons, that you would likely feel pretty incapable. You would be finishing last all the time. It would be really painful. And so if we know that you have the problematic ankle, can't we find another thing for you? Can't we find a way to have you run the marathon with some supports, right? And so I think that's when you're a kid, you don't have the choice of getting out of the marathon. You must be in school. So we have to find ways to provide the support so they can get through it and not be turned off to the learning process.
If you had a magic wand based on all of your experience, what would you like to see? You know, we talked about building that relationship and understanding the function, but really kind of talking about an FBA for a second, what would you like to see more of, or what would you like caregivers to advocate for or educators to advocate for in either developing the FBA or kind of just anything in that world to better support our students?
I think I would want, this is, I don't know if this is directly answering it, but I have this thought. I'm speaking like a step below, like the foundational, you know, and I have the thought that if we could reframe our perspective on challenging young people and think about them as behaving exactly as they should be behaving, given their nervous system and given their learning history, that if you had their nervous system and you had their learning history, you would be behaving in the exact same way. So if you could get your head around that concept, that this behavior makes sense in the context in which it's occurring, nervous system, vulnerability, previous learning, right? Then we're going to be able to come at the interaction, the FBA, the chain analysis, the interventions, the assessment, you know, in a way that's going to have them working with us. because we're going to come at it there's just a different way you approach somebody if you truly believe that they're doing the best they can. If you think that they are trying to upset you, or they are trying to disrupt the class, or they are, you know, if you frame it from that angle, this is the essence of what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, right? This is the cognitive side. Like, the what we think affects how we feel. But the problem is that of the 60,000 or so thoughts that we have in a day, the majority of them are complete nonsense. They're not true. They're judgments. They're false. You wouldn't share them with other people, some of them, right? And this is true for everybody. So we can't trust our thoughts. We can't treat our thoughts as facts. We have to be willing to say, is there another perspective I could take on this? When we're open to that, this is what we do as therapists, but this is what we're teaching our clients to do, right? If we're open to that, and if a teacher is open to that, or a parent is open to that, then we can start thinking in a broader way. Then we open up our thinking. We're not rigidly focused on this one thing, which is often driven by emotion. We're opening up our cognition. I wonder what else could account for this. What might I be missing here? And then that allows us to then move into the assessment. I mean, an FBA is really an assessment. Like, what's causing this? And if I come at it with a predetermined idea of what's causing, you know, in a way, I have this thought, like, when I get a hypothesis in my mind, this is how science works. Prove me wrong. Let's find out if this hypothesis stands up, right? Like, is it always true? Is it true that this happens every time you're hungry? You know, or maybe we're on the wrong path here. Let's try a different approach. Maybe it has something to do with sleep, or maybe it has something to do with this particular teacher who reminds you of your relative who did that thing. You know, like, we have to be open to, it probably isn't what you think it is. And the only way we're going to figure it out is with the young person's input. Sometimes psychological testing can be helpful because that gives us some, with a young person who may have some expressive language problems or some cognitive deficits or a little insight or something, it may help us get a little x-ray into maybe some of the stuff that's going on. But even then, we're going to still have to take it back to the young person and say, does this resonate with you? Do you think this could be what's going on? Because who's going to work on something they don't believe is important to work on? So I know you're asking about how to do an effective FBA. And I'm really saying, how do you effectively connect with the kid so you can do the FBA? Because I think your listeners probably know how to do an FBA.
Well, I think you answered the question beautifully. You really did. And is exactly, it's everything that you said in terms of perspective and empathy and input, and all of that really is at the essence of starting a process to support a student. So I think it was excellently said. As we wind down, what is a question that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked you?
I would say that we sort of think about these young people as a product of a transaction between their nervous systems and the world over time. And there's this emerging concept in mental health that when people have emotional reactions that are hard to understand for other people, that they're invalidated. They're told by everybody that you're making too big a deal out of this, or your emotions are too big, or calm down, or, you know, whatever. And the problem with that is that young people learn from that to not trust their emotions. And so we call this the transactional model of emotion dysregulation, that when you have an intense emotion, it gets invalidated inadvertently. And by the way, all of us invalidate everybody at times. We're not looking for 100% here. But if that child gets a lot of invalidation, then they're going to be more dysregulated. So for example, you come home from work and you're really stressed because it was raining and you got caught in traffic and it took way longer to get home. And you come home and you say to a loved one, I'm so frustrated that I had to sit in that traffic today. And your loved one says, well, you should have left work early. Right? They're trying to be helpful because they're giving you a solution to the problem. But what you really need there, or I don't know why you're making a big deal out of this. I told you to leave early, right? What you really need is, oh, that is so irritating. Right? And so if we do that, this concept of if we can meet the child's emotion where it is and assume that it makes sense, even if we don't understand it, and we validate it, we acknowledge that it makes sense. If it doesn't make sense, we can ask, tell me more, so we can make sense of it. But that transactional model is what leads to people being invalidated over time. And then these kids who we're talking about today have often been what we call traumatically invalidated, meaning when they when somebody invalidates them, they fly off the handle. And so we have to teach people to be more validating. And then ultimately, we have to teach the young people how to validate themselves, you know, as they get older.
Final question. If you had a tip to put on a billboard for parents, what would it be and why?
Okay, so this is a funny little phrase, and it comes from a Buddhist monk who was presenting to a group of other Buddhist monks. And I think it applies to parenting. So the phrase would be, your child is perfect as they are, and they could use a little bit of work.
Excellent.
But the bold pace would be perfect as they are, because all behavior makes sense in the context in which it occurs. Perfect as they are, they're doing exactly what their brains are telling them to do and what their brains are supposed to do. And then in small type, I'd put, and you could use a little bit of work, as we all could.
So true. Amazing. Before we say our final goodbye, I would love our guest, Britt, to give us some information on how folks can find him.
Thank you, Wendy. So we have a website where we post a monthly blog, whatworksswithteens.com. And that blog is more about like little tips for teachers, coaches, doctors, therapists, parents, etc. My website for my clinical practice is capitalyouthservices.com. We run a clinic for adolescents in Montgomery County, Maryland.
I really appreciate your time to come on today and speak with me about this. I know it's going to resonate with a lot of folks. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Wendy.
You bet. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.